The Business Growth Podcast by legendary entrepreneur Dan Bradbury gives you the best strategies to grow a profitable, sustainable company that isn't dependent on you. Whether it be how to hire and lead a world-class team, business finance, marketing, time management, growth through acquisition, or maximizing your company's value before you exit, this podcast is for you. And now, your host for the Business Growth Podcast, Dan Bradbury.
Okay, guys, hello. Welcome to this special episode of the Business Growth Podcast. This is a Q&A episode. We get questions all the time on the different social media platforms, so we thought we would take a selection of them, and I will answer them for you here live. So welcome to the show, Ed Taylor.
Woo, Ed Taylor!
Ed's in charge of business development at DB Limited. So Ed, take us away with the questions.
Okay, so first one. I make a good return from Facebook advertising, but it takes 6 months to break even. Should I spend more or keep doing what I'm doing?
Yeah, good question. So it's hard to answer it myopically because the answer is it depends. I think that a lot of times people get too myopically focused on, oh, what's the return on ad spend or the return on time, but it's dependent upon other factors. Ultimately, turnover is vanity, profit is sanity. It's not just about what is your revenue for the ad spend, albeit that's a factor. It's also relative to how much cash does the business have. So a common mistake that I see is if the business is undercapitalized and it's going to take you 6 months before you start getting the money back in, then you're going to go broke. So the fact that in theory, on paper, you're making a big profit is irrelevant if you go under. But then equally, if you have got unrealistic expectations and because you don't get the money back in 6 seconds after you spend it on Facebook, then you drop the campaign that would ultimately have given you a very decent return over time, then you're shooting yourself in the foot. So I think that there's two questions. One is looking at the bigger picture of your business, your margins and how well capitalized you are. And the second one is it's about constantly improving. You know, it's about saying, yeah, okay, however good we're doing, can we do better? And the third one I'll throw in for good luck is over-dependence on any platform is high risk of failure. You know, a mentor of mine said that the number one is the worst number in business, because if you get over-dependent on any one platform, then you're in deep trouble. So it's about being diversified across platforms as well.
Brilliant, thank you. Number two, I hear you talking about finances a lot. I'm embarrassed to say this, but though I know that being a better financial side of the business could make a huge difference, I can't find the motivation to learn what I need to learn and do what I need to do. Frankly, it bores the shit out of me. Should I hire someone to help, or do I have to get over and figure this stuff out myself?
Yeah, well, it depends if you want to be rich. A very good friend of mine said to me a long time ago that getting rich is boring. You know, it's shiny penny syndrome. Everybody always wants to do the new and exciting thing. The same person said to me that money is like a good woman. You pay attention to her every day or she will leave you. And I think that the goal, you don't just want to get rich, you want to stay rich, you want to build wealth. And I think you need the skills not just of making money, the sales, the marketing skills, but also of keeping it, of investing it. And whilst I don't want anybody to have to do menial tasks, as it were, like I don't do my own bookkeeping, etc. The fact is, if you don't have a high level understanding of money, you're going to look like one of these professional footballers that's made millions in their career and ends up being bankrupt at age 42. You know, so I think there's no substitute. If you want to improve your business and improve your personal financial position, you need to become a more skilled business owner. And with extremely rare exceptions, you're not going to find a business owner that builds and maintains significant wealth that isn't financially literate. So for me, it's a non-negotiable, but you absolutely can and should leverage out the data entry, you know, the tax, I'm not a tax accountant, the taxes, the specialized side of things to somebody that you contract in or you employ.
Okay, thanks. So, Dan, I've been in business for 5 years and I would never sell my business. You're always suggesting maximising the value of your business. I don't even know the value of my business, so I have two questions for you. One, Do you need to know what my business is worth if I don't plan on selling it? And if so, why does it matter? How to figure out what my business is worth?
Great, okay, so let's answer them in that order. Firstly, it's a great question. The reality is, I believe you should always be prepared for sale, because if you don't sell your business, you've just bought a business. Mm-hmm. Right, so if you go, well, I'm not going to sell my business, so I don't really need to think about it, well, that's not true, because you are buying the business. You could be doing something else. You could close the business down and invest your time, energy, and capital elsewhere. So by keeping the business, you are in effect buying it. So you owe it to yourself to try and maximize the value, maximize the return on your time, your energy, your investments. So I think it's paramount. And then normally, I'm not talking about the polish that goes on things when you're trying to exit a business. I'm talking about the fundamentals. If the business is worth more to you, it would be worth more if you were to sell it. And obviously, currently, even though it looks like it might change in the not too distant future, entrepreneurs relief in the UK of 10% is a spectacularly great deal. And that can allow you, rather than paying an additional rate tax of 45%, to pay 10% on a big lump sum. Sometimes it can make sense to kind of cash in your chips. I was lucky to do that back in 2012, 2013, and it kind of secured me financially for life at that point. And it can make sense, but I'm in favour of at least having the option on the table of exiting. So then the second question, how do I figure out what my business is worth? Well, we could give a whole host of things, but fundamentally, and then I'll give you a tool which you can go and use. The driver behind it all, because you could go and get it valued independently, you could go to business brokers, you could look at comparables in the marketplace, but fundamentally, if someone was buying a business, what do you want to know? How much money does it make? And how reliable, predictable, and sustainable that profit is, right? Which is often summarized, it's called the multiple. What multiple of profit, a bit the pre-tax profit for simplicity, are we talking about? Is it 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 12, 15? And they're the driver. So you can. I think there are 10 component parts to weigh that up, but it boils down to, okay, can the business make more money, more reliably, predictably, sustainably? And wherever you're at now, it's not so much about the absolute value, unless you're looking to exit today. It's about, can you improve that trajectory? Can you make it worth more over the time? The same way you can buy a house today, how much it's worth tomorrow or next month if there's a big crisis and the market collapses or whatever. It's about when you actually exit. You can look at comparables and say, is my house price appreciating over time? And the tool that I absolutely would use to do that is we developed our own tool because we didn't feel there was a good one out there called Business Profit Maximization Scorecard, or BPM Scorecard for short. We'll put a link in somewhere with the show notes with this episode where you can go and get it. You answer 30 simple multiple choice questions and it will give you a score. As to how you're doing. And fundamentally, the higher you score, the more your business will be worth. So it's about calibrating your score and then looking to make the tweaks in the areas. And when you get your score, it'll also give you a customized report on what areas you need to improve and what to do in order to do that. So go and get your BPM scorecard.
Brilliant. Dan, my business is a 50-50 partnership with my wife. I recently found out that she's been cheating on me for the last 6 months and she's soon to become my ex-wife. I want her out of the business. What do I do?
Okay, well, firstly, obviously, sorry for your unfortunate situation that you find yourself in. There's what you can actually do now, but I want to address, first of all, upstream, because ideally, upstream, I'm definitely not one to give marital advice, because there's a whole context of valuation of the business when you're splitting the assets with your soon-to-be ex-spouse. When I got married, prenuptial agreements weren't legal in the UK. They now are, so I'm in favour of those. However, I'm just going to talk about a level of business partner where I do have a lot of experience, both personally and with clients. The best place to figure out what happens when it goes wrong is in advance. So there needs to be a shareholders agreement, and it stuns me how few business owners have a good shareholders agreement when they've got equity partners. And that shareholders agreement should make provisions for what happens when you fall out. Note, I did not say if you fall out, when you fall out, and how that works. And there are different labels for different types of agreements, whether it be called a push-pull agreement and a variety of things like that. But fundamentally, it needs to be documented up front. And in order to do that, there's going to be a way to say, okay, Ed, if you and I are business partners, and one wants the other out,
yeah,
okay, if you say, I want to, the most common way it would be done is, if you say you want me out, you've got to name a price, and there might be preset criteria for how we will value the business if we fell out 3 years from today,
mm-hmm,
and then I've got the option to buy or sell at that price. So let me illustrate with a metaphor, which is more useful. So I've got three children, and the children, whenever they look to split up a dessert, for example, there's always an argument about who's got the biggest piece. Okay, so when it comes down to it, if there's just my eldest two children are kind of fighting over something, I will say to one of them, okay, you cut the piece. It's actually my middle one that I would choose, my boy Jensen, because he's the most competitive on it. I'll say, you get to cut this cake in half, and then Summer, you get to choose which piece you have first. Because then what that does is it puts the owner, it keeps Jensen honest, because it puts the onus on Jensen to cut the most perfectly evenly distributed piece of cake you've ever seen. You know, weighing scales are coming out. I mean, he's 9 as we film this. Weighing scales are coming out. There's like, it's absolute to make sure that it's as fair as can be. And that can very easily be documented in advance, but most people don't do it till after the fact. So if you've not yet fallen out, I had a client a few years ago who came in with his business partner, and it was very profitable business, 7-figure business, mid-6-figure profits. So he's making $500,000 a year. They're making great money. I said, do you have a shareholder agreement? Do you have a push-pull agreement? And they said, no, but we've been best friends for 20 years. You know, it's not going to happen to us. And I went, yeah, just to be safe, let's just do it anyway. Unfortunately, we got it in place. And lo and behold, a year or so later, it turned out that one of the partners had quite a serious drug problem and did some rather illegal behaviour, and the other partner wanted him out. And even though it was still difficult, you know, business divorces, just like marital divorces, are inherently difficult, it was made much easier because they weren't trying to kill each other and destroy the value of the business in the process. So ultimately, one business partner was bought out at a fair value. Did he want more? Yes, of course he did. But equally, the partner buying him out, did he want to pay less? Yeah, of course he did, but it was that both people could still be fair, as was subsequently demonstrated because they're still friends many years later. In fact, the partner that was bought out got married a year or so after being bought out of the business, and he asked the former business partner to be his best man. So that's a success story, but normally it's a horror story. But in the situation the person that asked questions in with the divorce now, yeah, unfortunately you're in for a great deal of distress, unfortunately. Look, I am generally just in favour of negotiating in good faith. Negotiating in good faith, and you've got to do it cleanly and as swiftly as possible. And it's easy for me to say this. It's a lot harder when you're in it, even though I have been in a divorce situation. Figure out what she wants in this situation. Figure out what she wants, and do your utmost to give that to her in good faith. But obviously, get legal advice, and it's all in the specifics of your situation. But that would be my rule of thumb.
Brilliant, thank you. Next question. So, Dan, my business got into bind last year, and I had to spend the cash I've been saving to pay my VAT bill. I owe around £35,000. I just don't have the cash to pay it. Should I try to get a loan to pay this off?
Yeah, great. I remember this question coming in, so I know the individual. I won't mention your name, but I know the individual that this is from. So, look, my opinion might not be necessarily popular, but let's be clear. The VAT, as long as you've not been doing anything illegal, the VAT is a business debt. Okay? So, in my head, unless HMRC are trying to wind the company up, You know, if it's just that, oh, we are late, okay, they will be very negotiable. It doesn't make sense to borrow money, which is another business debt, to pay, rob Peter to pay Paul. Because now you owe a bank money, which is, and the bank's only going to lend you money, the business money, if it's personally guaranteed by you. So now effectively your house is on the line versus owing HMRC. Plus you're going to pay additional interest in order to do that. Okay, that's something that in my mind doesn't make sense. HMRC are the biggest unsecured lender in the UK. I forget the number, the stats are publicly available, but it is an astonishingly large amount of money is lent out. And because it's, you know, because it's defined by the government, etc., the interest rate they charge, I forget what it is right now, but it's something pathetically small amount above base, the base rate, and the base rate's at a historic or round or equal to historic lows right now. So you are paying a negligible amount of interest. I'm not saying take the piss with HMRC, because they can come back and bite you, but if you ring them up and do your utmost to negotiate with them, they will do a payment plan. Now, note, subset, they will also ask you if you've gone and asked and attempted to borrow the money to pay them. And if you haven't attempted to do that, they generally say, no, we're not going to give you a payment plan. Mm-hmm. But I still kind of go, all else being equal, I'd rather negotiate directly and just deal with them, because the interest rate will be lower, and you're not having to put your house on the line.
Brilliant. Thanks, Dan. Dan, I own a gym and my best employee keeps asking for a raise. She's already paid pretty well for being a personal trainer and I don't think she should be paid more. But I'm afraid that I'll lose her and many of my clients along with her. How do I avoid giving her a raise and convince her to stay?
Great question. I've had this experience, literally having bought, owned and sold and still owning gyms. Look, regardless of the type of business, the conversation looks like this for me. Your people are your most valuable asset. Really, regardless of business, it's the people that make the business work.
Okay.
So if this employee is looking for a raise, I mean, there's a genuine debate about whether they're worth it or not. So there's two levels to this. There's a tactical level and a strategic level. At a strategic level, I'm always in favour of having my options open. In other words, I want to have deal flow. I want to have a substitute bench, as it were. So, you know, if my striker gets too expensive, I can take him or her off and I've got somebody that's just as good or similar on. I don't want to be held over a barrel. So I'm in favour of having deal flow. I'm in favour of having options. I give a lot of time and thought to who my backups are, what my subs bench is for all the key roles in all my businesses. If you study Warren Buffett, and I'm a huge Warren Buffett fan, one of the most important things he gives time and thinking time to is to how he would replace the MDs or the CEOs of all the Berkshire Hathaway businesses. I think that's paramount, so you're not vulnerable. Tactically, looks like this. So it was with you, Ed. We don't have one of these conversations, but you know, well, just to preempt it downstairs, it'd go, great, Ed, you want to get more money. How much would you like to make? And for purpose of the examples, let's say it was £30,000. You're on £30,000, what do you want to make? I want to make £50,000. And goes, great, fantastic. I would love for you to make £50,000. Why do you want to make £50,000? Because it'll allow me to buy a house, it'll allow me to do this, it'll allow me to take over the world, it'll allow me to invest in Bitcoin. Maybe not such a good idea. You know, okay, great. So I understand the person, I understand their motives, and I'm aligned with them. I would say, great, I'd love to pay you that. I'm sure you can appreciate that it just needs to make sense for the business to do that. Because you do a great job, obviously, if they do. If they don't do a great job, that's a different conversation. But assuming, because I think you mentioned that it's best employee, assuming that they're doing a great job, it just needs to make sense for the business to do that. So let's talk about now, Ed, what has to happen in order for it to look like, what your performance needs to look like, what the results in your part of the business need to look like in order for it to make sense and for me to be delighted to give you £50,000. And then hopefully you can get alignment rather than being combative. When it's combative, it's kind of like, oh, I don't want to give you more because if I give you more, I'm getting less. It's a zero-sum game on the profits of the business. And that's just not true. It's a collaborative approach, and they're part of the inputs that create the output called profit. I don't think you should overpay them. I think you need to have other options in case they do hold you over a barrel. But I'm just in favour of aligning with them so they can get on the same page. Because if they produce 2x, 5x the sales, for example, in a sales role or whatever, you know, it's probably going to make sense to pay them 2x the money. They bring in 5x the sales they were bringing in as a salesperson, paying them 2x the money is probably going to be a pretty darn good deal. You just need to discuss that and figure it out.
Awesome, thank you. My interior design business has really taken off over the last 3 years. It was my hobby and my passion, and I was only making about 12k per annum. 3 years ago, my social media referrals started going crazy, and now I'm doing over £200,000 per year. I know it sounds like a success story, but it's become my nightmare. I've had to hire a personal assistant, furniture movers, painters, and various other contractors. I did a business health check and found out that I actually made the most profit in 2016 when I only did 60k. Do I need to scale down?
Good question. Turnover is vanity. Profit is sanity. So you could say, yeah, going back to when you were only doing 60,000 and you're making much more in profit might be a good idea, but maybe not, okay? Because, first of all, congratulations, because you were doing something right to get that growth of business. So, it might be that, or it sounds like you've, sometimes there are one-time costs associated with scaling up. You have to get an office, you have to take on additional kind of costs, and therefore you'll make more money in subsequent years. It's an investment. Okay, like you might pay recruiting fees to hire people. Okay, which hurts your profits this year, but actually you're not going to have those fees next year. So I do think there's an overarching premise of being clear about what's going on with the numbers. And secondly, it's a different skill set, right? So being effective is about leveraging your assets, your skills, your existing team to produce more revenue. But then you've got also going to have the skills of being efficient at turning the sales into profit. And what do you have to be efficient at? Cost control. So oftentimes, and I don't know if the person asking this question has this tendency, but when people scale really quickly, it's often because their mindset and focus is about marketing and sales.
Okay.
And actually, you've got to be clear about, okay, how do I budget for this? It's not about going from 12 grand to 200,000. That's not the goal. It's going from 12 grand to 200,000 whilst keeping a net margin of X. Okay, so in other words, I can only afford to spend a certain amount of money in order to generate those additional sales. So a great example of mine in this from my younger, far more stupid years was I took a beer business from about 1.6 to 2.85, 2.95 million in revenue in a 12-month period. So a period of rapid growth, so about 50% growth from a low seven-figure business. As I recollect, on the 1.6 million, I made about $500,000 in profit.
Mm-hmm.
On the 2.85 million, I only made 350,000. In other words, I made £150,000 less in profit from an additional, whatever it is, 1.3 million in revenue. That's astonishing because I'd scaled, but not efficiently.
Okay.
So I didn't have economies of scales, I had diminishing returns, or in this case, literally negative returns. You know, it was costing me 12 grand a month for that additional million in revenue. But in addition to that, I've got a lot more stress because I went from, as a record, like maybe 10, 12 employees to 20, 20 plus employees. So there's more stress, more drama, more levels of infrastructure, more risk, more hassle. So it wasn't that, oh, scale up, I've now got a business less dependent upon me. It was more dependent upon me. Now, that's not always the case because that was the outcome given the skills that I had at the time. So as it relates to the interior design business, a business doesn't sustainably outgrow the business owner.
Okay.
Okay. So the person asking the question, what you need to do is you need to upskill yourself. And it sounds like financially, it sounds like you haven't got a clear written budget. You probably need to upskill yourself financially. You might need to upskill yourself because hiring people isn't a nightmare. Okay. It can be a nightmare if you don't know what you're doing. So it might be that you need to upskill yourself about recruitment and about managing and leadership. Okay? And if you upskill yourself in those areas, all of a sudden you get the leverage. So, somewhat convoluted, but there's a few things to think about.
Brilliant, thank you. Moving on to penultimate. I really enjoyed the chapters you released on from your new book. Did you decide on the title? And more importantly, when is it out?
Oh, good question. So I'm reticent to say on tape, even though I've got a date in mind.
Come on, commit.
Just in case it slips. Everything is now done from my end. It is literally publisher end, uploading to Amazon, that kind of stuff. So I believe it is within weeks. I was told on Tuesday of this week, we're recording this on a Thursday, I think it is, that it would undoubtedly be this month. And I'm reasonably confident that's true. So it could be by the time you're listening to this, it's out. I'm sure we'll be bleating about it all over the place when it is. And the book's title is Turnover is Vanity, Profit is Sanity, 9.5 Steps to Increasing Your Profits and Cash Flow.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it. So last question, the more difficult one for you. So, hey Dan, I've got a question for you. Why are you emailing me? If you're such a smart businessman, where's the proof? Do you live in a mansion? What kind of car do you drive? I'm sure you're just another one in the bedroom flat driving a shitty car trying to scam people out of their hard-earned money. Opt me out.
I'm not sure that's a question so much as a rant. Okay, but I will do my best to address it, even though I'm almost certain they've sent that, they've unsubscribed, and they're not listening to this answer, but I'll give it nevertheless. I'd say it sounds like you've already made up your mind. And it's not actually my job to try and persuade you. Okay? A younger version of myself would try and get onto the justification and go, oh yeah, look at this. I've had multiple seven-figure exits. You know, I've owned multiple supercars. I've, you know, got a whole buy-to-let property portfolio using no debt, only using cash. But ultimately, that's bullshit. In the sense of, there's always somebody that would find a justification for picking holes and, well, you're earning X, not Y, you're earning $500,000, not $1 million, you're earning... And the only reason somebody asks those kind of questions, if they're sincere in the questions, is because they're trying to validate whether or not it's got value for them.
Yes.
Because what I make, how much I'm worth, etc., doesn't bear any relevance other than the fact it might legitimize to you that I might be able to help you in your situation. And so a better reference, if I was checking somebody out, if somebody had asked the question, how do I know whether or not somebody's the right mentor for me, or this is the right mastermind group for me? I'd say that's a great question. I'd say do your homework. I'd say ask questions. I'd understand track record.
Okay.
So, you know, I've been doing masterminding and mentoring people for, I think it's 12-ish years now, might be a little bit longer. God, I'm getting old. I was like 3, 4, 5 years. And I'd say I've got a lot of clients that have been around me and in my programs for that length of time. People have been, not in 1 year, one time. They've been in 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. They've gone from startup to, spoke to a business owner this morning. He was with me from being a startup, even though we don't work with startups in Mastermind anymore. But he began, joined me as a startup, and he's now got 5 million plus in revenue, very profitable, locations all around the country, and he's preparing.
Brilliant, thanks Dan. So any last closing comments?
Yeah, so two things. First of all, if you've enjoyed this episode, give us the feedback, let us know, because we can do more shows like this. I've really enjoyed this, so if you got value from the answers to your questions, let us know and send some more questions in. Number two, actually I'll give you three. I'll give you two and a bonus one. Great, I'm sure we'll let you know. Check out Turnover is Vanity, Profit is Sanity, 9.5 Steps to Improving Your Profits and Cash Flow, coming to all good bookstores near you. Let's be honest, we're all just talking about Amazon. And then thirdly, it's definitely worth checking out the BPM scorecard. So Business Profit Maximization Scorecard, 30 simple multiple choice questions. Answer them, it'll give you a score, but it'll also give you a customized PDF that'll tell you which parts of your business, it'll score you in 10 different parts of your business, which areas need to improve and how to do that. So that's well worth checking out.
Awesome, brilliant, thank you.
Good man, thanks Ed.